It is September 7th, 2007. We are at the Atlantic Coast Bank in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today we are interviewing Rear Admiral John Paul Jones, Jr., Civil Engineering Corps, United States Navy, retired. Admiral Jones was born in Brunswick, Georgia, on August 7th, 1932. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview Admiral Jones on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me today is Gerhard Tam, who will operate the equipment. I will now begin the interview. Admiral, your bio sheet indicates that you enlisted in the Navy in June of 1954, and you continued on serving for 33 years. Please tell us, if you will, where you were, what you were doing in that summer of 1954, and carry us forward through your honorable career, if you would, please.
Well, actually, in the summer of 1954, I graduated from the Naval Academy in June of 1954. And my first duty start, I got married graduation afternoon in the chapel. So we've been married now since 1954. It's amazing how quickly 53 years can go by. My first duty station was aboard the USS Calvert, APA 32, home ported in San Diego, California. I served on that ship as a CIC officer and also served in the engineering divisions. And I left the ship after about 20 months and was sent by the Navy to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, as part of my request to be transferred from the line to the Civil Engineer Corps. I got up there in Troy with about 20 other young naval officers who were transferring from line to staff, and we had... I think that's 14 months, something like that, of study. We all got bachelor's degrees in civil engineering, and my first duty station as a Civil Engineer Corps officer was in the Public Works Center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. At that point in time, we had had one child, and so the three of us went down to Gitmo, and that was a very enjoyable 2 years. Climate was wonderful. The scuba diving was great, so we really enjoyed that. And when I left there, I was posted to the Naval Auxiliary Air Station, Port Isabel, Texas. Was there only for a year. Then the decision was made. It was basically a brand new Naval Auxiliary Air Station that had been finished only shortly before I got there. And after about a year, the Navy made the decision to close it. So I went from there up to Corpus Christi and served on the staff of the Chief of Naval Air Advanced Training, the Cenovantra staff. And I was there for about 3 years, two and a half perhaps, I'm not sure now. And then I was assigned to go to school to get a master's degree, and I was accepted at Stanford University, and I spent a year at Stanford in Palo Alto, California, and got a master's degree in civil engineering. And then the real fun started for me in my career. I went from there to MCB-4, that's Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 4. I joined them in Argentia, Newfoundland, and I took the outgoing operations officer, got on the same airplane and left, and I got on the parade ground and did what I had to do because we had a change of command at the same time. The new skipper came up on the same plane with me, and then we finished the work there in Argentia, Newfoundland, and went back to Davisville, Rhode Island, where my wife and family was. That was the home port then for most of the Atlantic Fleet Seabees.
By this time, you must have been a lieutenant or soon to be a lieutenant commander?
I was a lieutenant when I got to the battalion. I made lieutenant commander the following year, and the XO was reassigned, and I fleeted up from ops officer to XO. And our our second deployment was about 8 months in Guantanamo Bay. It was interesting to go back down there as a temporary bachelor and live in the CB camp and leave my wife behind again in Davisville. But that was a great tour. We were we were being let's see, I guess I can back up just a second. The at about that time, the Castro had severed the water supply line to Guantanamo. And John D. Bulkley, Rear Admiral John D. Bulkley, was the naval base commander, and he was a gruff old guy. I had met him before when I was a teenager because he was the executive officer on a ship that my father was stationed on, and so I knew him from teenage years. And he said, "The hell with them. We're not going to worry about that. We'll get our own water." And so we had a ship came in, and they made water on the ship and furnished the base. And that was then we built a desal plant. It was actually built by a contractor, but the contractor was hiring all my steel workers to work at night, moonlighting, to build this desalinization plant to provide water. The admiral was torn between wanting to get the water plant done, but not wanting to hurt, you know, these guys that be out there climbing around in the steel and tired after working all day. So finally, we had to knock that off and let the contractor survive on his own with his own hires. My steel workers didn't like that too much, but no, that's what we did anyway. From there, the battalion went home. We were home about 3 or 4 months, and then we headed out to Rota. Naval Base Rota, Spain, was actually the Spanish Naval Base, and we were tenants on the Spanish Naval Base. And the battalion, MCB-4, started a major construction project for family housing. We didn't finish it, and no battalion came in behind us, so because Vietnam came along, and the battalion that was supposed to relieve us in Rota, Spain, in 1960... five actually went to Vietnam instead. So in the meantime, I left the battalion. My relief came in after about 5 months of that deployment, and I was ordered to Camp David to be the officer in charge of the president's retreat in the mountains there of Maryland.
Did they ask you to go through any excessive or special background checks? Did you know that was coming?
I knew where they had where I was going, or if I passed the interview. Then they sent me to be interviewed. I went to the Pentagon and sat and cooled my heels for about 2 hours in the outer office of Joe Califano. Joe, I don't know what his title was at the time, but he's been around in the Democratic circles for years and years and years. And finally, the Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, who was his administrative assistant, I guess, said, "Look, Mr. Califano is not going to have time to give you an interview, but you're fine. You can go." And I figured that Joe might have looked through a peephole and decided that I didn't have palsy and I was, you know, was okay, so they let me go to Camp David, and that was kind of an interesting exercise. Camp David was a marvelous experience. I was only there 2 years, and that was enough. I didn't want to be there any longer than that. But being around the president and his staff was just amazing. I could tell you a lot of anecdotes, but I'm not supposed to talk about those years, so I won't. But it was a fun year, some amazing things going on. And, of course, we're getting involved into the war more and more in Vietnam. And I knew that my future, as far as the Civil Engineer Corps was concerned, was to get to Vietnam in some fashion, because we had about half the Civil Engineer Corps was over there doing something, either helping run the big contract that we had with the American construction industry doing things in Vietnam, or they were over there involved with the Seabees. Unfortunately, I had to wait a year because of classified stuff that was going on at Camp David. They put me on ice for a year, and they sent me to the War College in Newport, Rhode Island. So I got another year's education at the expense of the Navy.
Where was your family when you were at Camp David? Was there housing up there? And
there was one set of quarters on the camp, and that's where the camp commander, me, and my family lived. There was what we call the Horseshoe, which was down at the foot of the mountain on the western side of the mountain. And there were, I don't know how many now, 20 or 30 houses down there where other folks could, you know, officers and enlisted could live if they had their families with them.
So you were on duty 24 hours a day, in effect, while you were there?
Well, not really. Fortunately for us, and at least as far as being there is concerned, President Johnson did not use Camp David nearly as much as John F. Kennedy did. The poor guy that I relieved had been there for 4 years, I think, and Kennedy was up there all the time, and he hardly had a chance to turn around and get any sleep. But Lyndon didn't use it that much. He did use it a good bit, but for him it was a good bit. But he liked his ranch, so he went to the ranch a lot, which was fine with us. I mean, we wanted him there, but we also, it was sometimes really nerve-wracking. Lyndon could be a nerve-wracker, I guarantee you that. But he was a real gentleman to my girls. He loved my little girls, and he wanted them to meet the helicopter whenever he came up, and he would put them in the car with him. Take the girls to Aspen, the main presidential lodge. The first time he did that, this is just kind of an aside, but I'll throw it in anyway. The first time he did that, he had them down there, and there weren't any toys around, and he wanted the girls wanted something to do, and my youngest, Karen, was in his lap, and I was in the kitchen, looking through one-way glass at my daughter and cringing. She crawled up in his lap, and she had a glass of Coca-Cola in her hand, and she spilled it all over him. And he gently set her on the floor and called for the chief steward, and the chief steward went in, and he says, "Get these girls some toys," and just about like that. So he turned to me and said, "Toys." So I hustled home and brought them some toys, and they weren't too happy about that, because I heard the other little girl say, "Well, these are our toys." You know, but they, I went out after that and bought toys and stocked the Aspen Lodge with some new stuff so that they could do something besides spill Cokes on the president. Anyway, I got out of there and went to the War College and was fortunate enough to be assigned to as commanding officer of MCB 62. And I flew to Vietnam and took command in, I think it was right around the 1st of July, 1968.
So you had to be a full commander by then?
Yes, I was a full commander by then.
Right.
Actually, I was selected for commander under a program that where the Civil Engineer Corps needed commanders, and I wore the insignia of a commander, but I was still officially and paid as a lieutenant commander when I took command.
Frocked.
Yeah. Frocked the commander.
Yes.
They did a whole bunch of us that way. It was called a 5909 or something like that promotion. But it didn't make any difference. I had been the ops officer in the XO of a battalion, and I was confident that I knew what I was going to, that I could do what I had to do. And I, you know, it was a great tour. So I went to Da Nang and took command, and we were in Da Nang for about 3 months. And it was wrapping up some projects and getting ready to go back to Gulfport, Mississippi, which was home port. And I would lose about a third of the battalion, and then get about a third of them replaced and do training at home and then go back to Vietnam just to another deployment. In the meantime, my family was settled into a house just a few houses north of Highway 90, which runs right along the Gulf. And we enjoyed that place, and my wife really enjoyed Gulfport. It was a lovely town and friendly people. So then, after about 4 months, I went back. I sent an advance party to Dong Ha Combat Base, which was in the Northern I Corps, just a few kilometers south of the demilitarized zone. And when I got there, the battalion advance party had been there a couple of weeks, and they were turning over the equipment and getting ready for the main body to come in. We had, in those days, each battalion that was deployed was overmanned, which was, you know, fine. We had almost 1,000 enlisted men in the battalion and 23 or 4 naval officers. So it was a pretty big construction operation. We did, in Dong Ha Combat Base, which was in that area, which was the longest deployment I had, was 62. We did a lot of road work. We built, the road was called QL9, and it was a road from Dong Ha all the way out to Vandegrift Combat Base. We had originally been tasked to build the road all the way to Khe San, but Khe San had been abandoned after the Marines took such a beating up there. They got out finally, and Khe San was abandoned. So we only went to the northwest corner of Vandegrift Combat Base, and there we stopped. And beyond that was Indian country for sure. Lots and lots of mine damage to equipment. The Viet Cong were expert at putting, using mines, and they deterred us as much as they could with mines. Had several deaths from mine explosions and lost a lot of equipment. It's almost like the improvised explosive devices that are being used in Iraq today. We finished up that deployment by completing the bridge over the Kwa Viet River in Dong Ha, and that's the same bridge that's the subject of a book that was written by Marine Colonel John, what's his name? Let me see the time. Ready to go on? Okay. At the close of that deployment, we had to close down the Dong Ha combat base. I mean, as far as the Seabees were concerned, we were going to be relieved, but the battalion, because of the politics of that war, Richard Nixon was drawing things down, and we were among those who were not going to come back to Dong Ha. We did come back to Da Nang again, but Dong Ha was being turned over to the Vietnamese. And so it came upon us to retrograde all of the equipment down to Da Nang to put on a ship to go back to the States. And unbelievable as it may seem, the requirement for us to clean this equipment had to meet Department of Agriculture standards, so that if a bulldozer was going to be put on a ship and sent back to be recycled somewhere and used in another battalion or another theater, it had to be cleaned to Department of Agriculture standards. So I stayed behind with about 100-man contingent, largely from Alpha Company, the equipment company, to get all that retrograded stuff, and we loaded it all on barges and shipped it down to Da Nang before I was able to pull that last 100 men out. So we were there about a month longer than we would have been ordinarily if we had just had somebody come and relieve us. And another thing that happened during that Dong Ha deployment, the nine months of it for me, I took the 5-day R&R, and I met my wife in Hawaii. And this was in August of 1969. The first morning that we woke up in the hotel room on Waikiki Beach, my wife was very concerned about Hurricane Camille, because she had been hearing about it on the radio. Of course, I had heard nothing about it, really, but she was concerned. So she got up and went down into the lobby and bought a newspaper. I guess we didn't have a television set in the room. Must have been. She went down to get a newspaper and came back up practically in hysterics because the headlines read something like hundreds feared dead in Gulfport, Biloxi, Mississippi from Hurricane Camille. Really upsetting to her and upsetting to me, obviously. So we got dressed and went out to the COMCB PAC, the Commander Naval Construction Battalion's Pacific Fleet, who was an old friend. He was a captain. He was the chief staff officer. Was a captain, and he had been the commanding officer of MCB-4 when I was the executive officer. So he was a really close friend and a good guy. He got on the telephone as soon as he saw me come in with my wife Winky. He was having a staff meeting, but he had glass so he could see out in the outer office. And as soon as he saw us walk in, he stopped his staff meeting and sent everybody away. He got on the phone, and ultimately, after a couple of hours that morning, we found out that my mother and father and the three children, they were staying in our house while we were going to be gone for that week. My mom and dad were there to babysit the three kids, that they had gone to the base overnight, and that they were all safe and fine, but that our house was completely gone. We were three houses up, as I mentioned earlier, from the Gulf, and the house was just gone. There was nothing left but the slab. So there was no way I could go back to the States. I just put my wife on an airplane and said, go home and do the best you can, and I went back to Vietnam. And I didn't let anybody else go. I talked to the XO, to my XO, on a telephone line, and he said he had let four people go home. And I said, what for? And with stuff like, well, the carport was damaged or the car was damaged. And I said, well, that's not enough. Don't let anybody else go. And he said, well, we'll probably have a mutiny. And I said, no, you're not going to. Just tell them I'll be home shortly and that I lost my house, and I'll have a request mask for anybody who wants to see me all at once as soon as I get back to the CB camp. And I did, and I told them what happened to me, and I said, nobody else is going home unless you got a serious injury or you've lost your house. And that was the end of that. Didn't send anybody home. It was difficult not to do that, but it had to be done. I mean, we had a mission to do, and you can't do it without good people. So anyway, that'll spoil my tour a little bit there and deployment a little bit there in Vietnam, but all things considered, it worked out beautifully. I had one more three-month deployment in Da Nang before I was reassigned to the Southern Division in Charleston, South Carolina, Southern Division of Naval Facilities Engineering Command in Charleston, South Carolina. My wife had already left and gone to Charleston. She lived in a HUD trailer for about a year and then went to Charleston and was looking for a place for us to buy or live when I got there. Yeah, it's just,
ready?
Yep. So I got back into Charleston and joined the staff of the Southern Division NAVFAC, Naval Facilities Engineering Command, and the other thing that happened is at about that time when my I was being relieved in Vietnam, and I got a message from the commanding officer of Southern Division in Charleston that my wife was in the hospital and had had stomach surgery. So I was really anxious to get home, but by the time I got home, she was out of the hospital and she was fine. She had had a blockage of some kind that they operated on her. So things were really happening, a lot of things happening at once. I mean, we bought a house, had no furniture because we lived in that, she had lived in that HUD trailer. And so we bought a house and we went up into North Carolina and bought a bunch of furniture to furnish the house. And I mean, it was it's kind of a rough time in our life there for about a year. Anyway, the Charleston tour was wonderful. We had a lot of work to do. NAVFAC no longer has an office in Charleston. They moved it down to Jacksonville in a restructured engineering capability. But Charleston was a wonderful place to work. Good old Southern folks, locals that were on the staff there, wonderful engineers and architects, knew the business really well, and was a pleasure and to be a part of that organization. From there, and that was a three-year tour. From there, we went to Washington, D.C., actually to Alexandria, Virginia. There we sold our old house in Charleston. We bought another one in Alexandria, and I worked at the headquarters of the Naval Facilities Engineering Command for 3 years. And during that time, I was selected for captain and made captain. And that was a typical Washington staff duty tour. A lot of things going on still in the CBs and in the Navy military construction programs. So I can't really say too much more about it. It was just a lot of work to do.
Where was that headquarters located? Was that in Crystal City or the Hoffman
Building?
No,
Hoffman Building.
It was in the Hoffman.
Yeah, we were in the Hoffman Building.
Okay.
They're no longer in the Hoffman Building. They're now out at the Washington Navy Yard.
Really?
Yeah. They took one of the old gun factory buildings and built a building inside of it. So it looks like the original building on the outside, but its inside is a very modern, well laid out office complex, just big enough for NAVFAC headquarters. It works, and the headquarters a lot smaller today than it was back in those days. Anyway, at that point in time, I was ordered to duty as Com C.B. Lant, Commander, Naval Construction Battalions, U.S. Atlantic Fleet. And it was good to be back in the CBs, and I did an awful lot of travel in the 2 years I had that job, and I went to Diego Garcia several times. I spent a good bit of time in Europe at Rota, Sigonella, other places where CBs were doing business, Holy Lock, I guess I got to Okinawa, Subic Bay. I mean, I learned over again how damn big the Pacific Ocean is. When you just fly until you think you're going to drop to go to some of those places. So it was a lot of travel involved, but it was wonderful to be back with the CBs, and they responded well to the things that I wanted them to improve. They did, and that was a very satisfying tour. As that tour wound down, I didn't know what was in store for me next, but it turned out to be a real plum. I was assigned as the commanding officer of the Western Division of the Naval Facilities Engineering Command, which at that time was located in the San Francisco area, actually in San Bruno, very close to the airport, to the San Francisco International Airport. We had responsibility for the Navy and the Marine Corps construction, military construction, for 9 western states, from Alaska to Nevada. Fallon was part of our operation. So at that point in time, the work being done up in the submarine service, work being done at in Washington State to build the Trident operating base on the Hood Canal was not a responsibility of the Western Division. They had the NAVFAC had a separate officer in charge of construction running that. But then they faded and phased out and basically relocated to Kings Bay, and so WestDiv had to pick that up and finish that work as well. That was a 3-year tour, and I was doing an awful lot of travel then too, from ADAC to San Diego. And in fact, I recognized at that very time that the Navy had closed the NAVFAC field office in San Diego several years before, back in the late 70s. And it turned out that was not a very good move for NAVFAC to have done that, because all of the flag officers that, practically all of them that I was serving, were stationed in San Diego. I mean, ComNav AirLant was there. AirPAC was there. SubPAC was there. 32nd Street Naval Station, which was always a beehive of activity, was there with its commanding officer, wanting to stand on my shoulders and push me farther and farther down, you know, one of those things that. So I spent more time flying back and forth to San Diego than I really ever wanted to do. And of course, flying the CO's conferences back in Washington, flying back to the Hoffman Building, and you know, you're a long way away, but it was a great tour, and resulted ultimately in me being selected for Rear Admiral when I was the CO of WestDiv. I don't think I've missed anything along the way as far as where we were all those years, but I left WestDiv in the summer of 1981, and I guess I had been frocked, at least ordered. I had a set of orders that said I could wear the insignia of a rear admiral, and I put those on, and I went back to NAVFAC headquarters, where I'd been several years before as the vice commander of the Naval Facilities Engineering Command and deputy chief of civil engineers. 3 years later, I was selected to go to be the chief and be commander of Naval Facilities Engineering Command. So we spent the last 6 years of our 33 years in Washington. Counting the 3 years that I was there on the staff back when I was a commander and a captain, was 9 years total in the Washington, D.C. area. That's really enough for anybody. So when we got out of the Navy, when I got out of the Navy, we decided to resettle back in the South somewhere. Both of us, my wife and I, native Georgians. So, time.
Yeah. Admiral, tell us a bit, if you would, please, about what you did subsequent to your retirement from the Naval Service.
Well, my first reaction was that I didn't really want to go to work in a 9-to-5 job, which it always turns out to be 50 hours, 60 hours a week, and I had been doing that for a long time, and I didn't really want to do that again. So I did accept a position as a member of the board of a big construction company, a West Coast firm. But before we left Washington, before we left the Alexandria area, I was asked by a recently retired classmate if I would help him put together a proposal for construction of a huge submarine base for the Indian Navy. And I accepted that. And for about a month, I worked in Washington, D.C., in their office downtown Washington. And we put together a very nice proposal. We flew all of us. Actually, they didn't pay for it. We did, and the company paid for it, to New Delhi. And the other teams were one from France, one from Holland, one from Germany, and one other firm from the United States. So two U.S. firms, one Holland, one French, and one German firm. We were all there together. We toured the site, which was on the west coast of India, about halfway down at a place called Kawar, and needed a breakwater. We had a breakwater consultant that we had brought along with us, and we made a very good proposal, and we went back and then priced it and submitted the final proposal priced, and we didn't win it. The Dutch firm won it, the one from Holland. And my reaction is that they were probably subsidized by the government of Holland, because this was a major waterfront project, and they do have great expertise, because they'd be flooded if they didn't. But I suspect that the government subsidized them to keep them active, because there was no major work in Holland right then, and the Dutch government did not want them to pack up and go home somewhere. And that's my suspicion. Of course, there's no proof of that. But we made a nice shot at it and didn't win. And then I accepted this position with the construction company on the board. And in the meantime, we moved out of Washington and down to Fernandina Beach. I continued to consult with that company for several years, and then I did some consulting work for two or three other companies, and I'm still doing that. In fact, as we speak today, I'm waiting for a phone call from someone I'm trying to recruit for a project manager position for a firm that won the BOS contract at Naval Air Station Pensacola.
That's a big contract, I would think.
It is.
Yes.
10 years, $25 million a year, 10-year contract.
Wow. Yeah.
And I talked to a retired Civil Engineer Corps captain late yesterday, and he's going to call me back in a day or so. So I'm just kind of a little networking and recruiting.
That's great.
At the moment.
One would think that all of those great things that have happened to you after the service can be attributed back to some of the great things that happened to you in the service. Could you assess what the Navy did and how it contributed to your entire in life?
The Navy gave me everything that I have today. I mean, they, first of all, the Naval Academy education was superb. Not as an engineering engineer so much, but in the professional development, leadership skills that you can learn at the Naval Academy, the personnel skills are unbelievable and very good. And then the Navy accepted my request to transfer to the Civil Engineer Corps and gave me a civil engineering degree and a master's degree in civil engineering and the opportunity to work with professionals all around the world for 30-odd years. So everything that we have today and the ability that I have, such as it is due to the Navy. It's a wonderful, I'd do it all over again in a heartbeat.
That's great.
And, in fact, I called the then chief back when the first Gulf War went down and asked him if he needed any help. I'd been happy to go back to Washington and pitch in, but I'm too damn old now to worry about it.
I hear. Admiral, thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of our nation. We appreciate it very, very much. This concludes the interview with Rear Admiral John Paul Jones, Jr., United States Navy, retired.